You're listening to episode 49 from SIW Radio, the podcast series from SecurityInfoWatch.com. This week's program is a Q&A that follows last week's webinar on public transportation security, mass transit issues. You can view that webinar by going to www.securityinfowatch.com/webinars/public_transportation. You can also find it listed in the archive on our webinars page, www.securityinfowatch.com/webinars. The following is our Q&A program from that webinar.
We had Doug DeLever, former chief of police for Maryland Transit Administration, Fred Jant, editor of Mass Transit Magazine, Larry Mays, group director of transportation and logistics for ADT Security Services, and John Piccinini, vice president of sales for Hirschel Electronics. John unfortunately can't join us, but the other three gentlemen are online. Larry, Doug, Fred, thanks for coming on the program. We're going to go ahead and continue the Q&A that we ran out of time for yesterday on the webinar. And one of the questions that came in yesterday was about the most effective way to prevent assaults against bus drivers. Doug, is that something that came up a lot at the MTA?
Yeah, but at the MTA, they have an emergency button they can push, and it lets them know exactly where they're at on like a GPS. And but preventing assaults, I mean, they're not boxed in. So an assault could happen, but we tell them if assault happened, lock the bus down and push the emergency alarm.
Gotcha. Should they be boxed in?
No, the public want access to the bus drivers, and if they get boxed in, it's more of an inconvenience of what they have to deal with.
Okay. Any other thoughts on that? I mean, obviously we see that in the aviation community where they lock the doors and there's no access into the cockpit these days, but is that even practical on buses? I mean, that's a huge expense, obviously, to retrofit any bus to do that.
It is. Go ahead, Brett.
I'm sorry, this is Larry.
Larry.
I think that, the reason for the, this whole cockpit armored door is because a plane can become a weapon itself. And, if they can access the cockpit, they could force a plane, as we've seen in the past, fly into something and be very devastating. The outcome would be devastating. So, and I think to Doug's point around bus drivers, that we haven't seen where a school bus or a passenger bus is going to become a weapon in and of itself. So I don't think that makes sense, and it's probably cost prohibitive. But I do think that putting video cameras on buses, where you can monitor the activity of the students and the bus driver, is somewhat of a deterrent, maybe not totally. It can also, parents, it could be used as a teaching tool so parents could see how kids behave on buses. Other than that, I'm not sure the number of incidents. I'm not sure we're at a crisis level yet in terms of people attacking bus drivers. But I don't think it's prudent that we would build some kind of armored structure around the bus cab or the bus driving cab.
It's very true what you said, Larry, because some buses that doesn't have smart passes, people are putting money into the boxes and need change also. And when you tell somebody to have change, but some of them are still doing the old style.
That's a great point. Well, now, one of the other questions that came in, a lot of times when we talk about transit from a security and policing perspective, issues of safety get tied up with issues of security. And one of our listeners wanted to ask, how do we clarify what is safety issue and what is security issue? Doug, how would you define those? How would you separate those two areas?
Well, safety is to make sure that the equipment on the bus is equipped with a lot of buses in front that have the arms in front when passengers get off to keep them from walking in the street. The checking the wheels, because in Maryland we had a problem with the wheels coming off for a while. Checking the lug nuts and things like that, that's safety and risk management. Security is different because we're looking for the security of the passengers and the drivers. So safety and risk management is more or less making sure the bus is mechanically and physically able to run that route.
Okay. Fred, is that how you see it in the industry as well?
I think so, but I also think that more and more those two aspects are being blended and are becoming one and the same. To Doug's point about the checking the lug nuts on the buses and stuff, you know, that could be a security issue as well, where, you know, someone is vandalizing a bus and, you know, losing lug nuts, things like this. Not saying that, that this happens that often, but, you know, there's that issue. And I think that if you look at them as, you know, even if they're not one and the same, it's going hand in hand together, that, you know, safety increases your security, and better security, you know, increases your safety, I think you'll be better overall.
Mm-hmm. Larry, when you're talking to security managers for transit in your role at AET, do you see any clear definition between those two in terms of what are priorities for them?
Well, I think that, it kind of blurs. I think safety is kind of a lead measure, because you can do preventive things around safety. Number of, you know, how many times it goes into the depot for maintenance, you know, whether or not the you've got the right tires on the bus. I think you can be more proactive and have more predictable outcomes with safety, where security is kind of a hit and miss, because a lot of times the behavior of people is so unpredictable. When you're trying to provide security, because who would ever think that some of the things that go on a bus or in a public place, that is predictable. It's almost completely unpredictable. So I think that, you know, deterrence. I heard Doug talk yesterday about having the right number of law enforcement present. I think a presence of law enforcement. I think the presence of security is a deterrent. But security and the security outcomes are so unpredictable. What people actually do. It gets crazier and crazier.
Yes, it does. All right. Well, you know, I think that question segues into another question we had come in from the audience, and I thought this was we talk about collaboration in businesses today and in organizations, and pretty insightful question they asked: has security leadership trained the maintenance personnel of what kind of explosives can be affixed to railway or subway cars? And I think the sub question of that is, trained them how to spot those kind of things as well. You know, how do you empower more of your staff to spot security issues? But let's talk about just, you know, our maintenance personnel keen on and understanding of the security, especially the sort of the bombing issues today. Doug, how about you guys? Was that ever a discussion?
Well, we went down and talked to the bus drivers and gave classes on security and maintenance, because when you look at it, Jeff, these buses sit out in the lot all night long. When they sit down, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of vehicles at the different stations, and the bus driver is supposed to check them when they come in and when they go out. I mean, they check the vehicles, and you have to look to see whether that maintenance will come in when it's time to do it. But you can train people all day long, but they don't pull the required maintenance. And then we started looking at a checklist before the bus go out. We actually put officers at the at a booth at the MTA to check the buses before they went out.
Okay.
Which was a preventive, and, I mean, some of them didn't like it. They thought they was being held up, but we wanted to make sure that one thing we had a problem with, wearing seatbelts. Nobody wanted to wear the seatbelts, so we painted them orange to make sure that the officers can see them if they're going down the street, that their seatbelt was on. So it's just a matter of in-service training, bringing them back in, telling them what to look for, especially packages left on buses, because there's packages left on buses every day.
That's a great point. You know, when we talk about terrorism the suicide terrorist, you know, doesn't use it just an abandoned package. Typically, they're wearing it as a backpack bomb.
That's true.
But you know, packages have been used as tools before. In terms of that, it brings up a question about you know, what's more of a target? This came in from a transit director, and it's asked, you know, is rail more of a target than a bus route? What do you guys think?
Well, my theory is both of them are open systems. The rail is open system. You carry your luggage and back and forth and put it up over a bin. Nobody checks your luggage. Amtrak just started a program where they're putting the dogs on the trains to walk through, and if they see you at the station, they'll come in and snip. But on a bus, buses usually for inner city, and nobody's checking the buses. I mean, they're going, and like I said, in Seattle, they have a program where they actually have officers riding the buses, and some programs do it. But, you know, it's the idea of parking that car and getting on that bus. I'd rather see a uniform on it. And we used to ride the buses in Maryland. I can only talk about Maryland and not other properties, but when we used to do these transit roundtables, everybody would talk about what they were doing, which made it very good. And one time we had these connecting communities, which I talked about before, and it made the public more aware of what was going on.
That's a good point. Fred, what do you think in terms of a terrorism target? Do you think it's more of a target for trains at this point or buses?
I don't know if necessarily if it's either. I think rail may be more higher profile, which inevitably is what they're going to be likely after. Doug's right. They're both open systems. I think that just when you expect it to be one, it'll probably be the other.
That's a good point. When we talk about terrorism, and one of the points made on yesterday's webinar was that we have to empower the community to be responsive, to pay attention to their system, to be the eyes and the ears of security, because there can only be so many officers and scanners and cameras on these systems. If you can empower your ridership, you get extra sort of feet on the beat, if you will. A transit operator wrote, it seems that every time we remind our operators to look for packages that have been left there and remind our riders to do that, we get several of them who overreact and call in everything. What suggestions do you have to get the operators to have a better understanding about a suspicious package versus just a regular student's book bag? And how do you train your ridership as well on that?
Well, the fact is, if you see a package, we don't want them to touch it because it could be an explosive. If you see a package, it's better to be safe than sorry, and something happens. People leave packages every day. I mean, we had an incident where just going down into the system, one of the medical staff at one of the local hospitals left one of the meters they use, and it was sitting there, and it was ticking.
Mm.
And passengers see it, they'll call right away. I mean, the vigilance is there, but you don't want them to text it. We have people that pick up packages and bring it outside the station.
Right.
And you want them to call somebody first. I'd rather have one of the EOD guys, the explosive officers, come there and check it to be sure, because they'll send a robot there and blow the package up. We've had maintenance people leave their tool bags along the train tracks. And when you spot it on the camera, only thing you can see is an object there, like a bag, and you want that checked out. So you don't want the public to be picking up packages, but you want them to identify. Just like I said, every tip comes in is investigated.
Yeah, how do we get to the point where we're not overreacting? I mean, we obviously, we're limited on funds at some point. We can't roll, explosives teams and the robots to every package. How do we keep that from overreacting?
Say, Jeff, this is Larry. I think that there's no such thing as an overreaction because remember, the people that are trying to perpetrate these kinds of terroristic acts are testing the system as well to see what kind of response you get. So you can never tell. Just because it didn't go off doesn't, and someone notified the police and they responded, doesn't mean that we've wasted time and money. The system, when the airline industry first went through putting up the body scanners, the metal detectors, and TSA, at first everybody reacted that it was an overreaction. Now it's become a way of life. And I think in countries like Israel where there were terrorist attacks, and Doug, you were there, you could probably speak better to this, that there is a culture now that's aware. And in America, it's come to us as well. We have to be aware that the terrorists are trying to attack. We have to be sensitive, and there is no such thing as an overreaction.
And what Larry said is totally correct, because in Israel, we went to the Office of Tourism, the team that was with me, when they gave us a calendar and a clock with a card holder. And when we got to the new Ben-Gurion Airport, because they've opened the new one, they closed the old one, they tore the bags up when we told them we received gifts. Even they knew we were law enforcement, and they knew that the Office of Tourism gave us this object. They wanted to swab it, and they took everything out of the bags looking for it. So, I mean, you can't never overreact, because that's why they asked you if anybody packed your bags, anybody did this, did that, because it's easily done for somebody to put something in there. I'd rather have somebody check it than not check it.
Well, Fred, I want to bring you in because, I mean, I think you're very in touch with the business side of Mass Transit as editor of Mass Transit magazine. Certainly anytime we do if we have a suspicious package and we shut down a station and avert, trains from dropping off there, even if it's for just 20 minutes, or potentially some of these situations can take a couple hours by the time you get the robots there and the explosive ordnance teams. What are the business managers think of this? I mean, that's an impact on their budgets. I mean, and the scheduling operations.
I would think that, agreeing with Larry and Doug, that the prevention is money well spent. Whatever money you would have spent on this is insignificant compared to if you didn't do this and there was an explosive device that went off, just the loss of life alone. But also, if you spin that out and you go into, okay, I know, how much is ridership going to drop because people are now afraid to get on board your vehicles because of this? And, you know, and then all the other issues and everything else that you have to account for this. So far this year, just from snowstorms, Washington Metro has seen a drop in ridership that's cost them about $10 million. Okay, that's just from a snowstorm. Now, think about this as if, you know, you have an explosive device that goes off on one of your buses or trains, and your riders stop coming. You know, that's the sort of thing where I think that this is definitely money well spent.
That's a good point. Go ahead, Doug.
What he's talking about is very true. Like, in Israel, when they had those bus explosions, they have a mandate, it's cleaned up within 2 hours. Then sensationalize it, we get it on this side of the world, really, because we see where the explosion happened, but that's cleaned up within 2 hours. They don't want it laying around. They don't want all this. They got investigators to go out there, do what they got to do. In 2 hours, everything is back to normal because they've trained and trained and trained, but a five-year-old will see a package and identify it, and half the time they're right.
Well, we're kind of talking about return on investment a little bit here, and that was another question that came in, was our transit security directors and police personnel being forced today to prove the return on investment in their expenditures for security and safety? Doug, was that something that you had to prove ROI?
Yeah, but my theory is you cannot put a cost on that their return investment, because it's like Jeff and Larry said, one incident will happen, you can have the best system in the world, and one incident will happen will destroy you because you didn't do what you were supposed to do. They want to know, well, where was security at? Why wasn't this checked? Why wasn't that checked? Yeah, management worry about passengers and on time and can we get the system back up? Even when you have somebody on the rail system killed, Amtrak has got to the point now, they shut it down for several hours. And it's better to be safe and make sure the system is safe than to be sorry. And one incident can destroy your whole agency. You take, for instance, the train incidents in D.C. that they had. The passenger train, one train runs into another. And people are busy in there. If they see the operators talking on cell phones, they'll call you in right away. So they're starting to look, because that was a distraction, and it came out that one operator was talking on the cell phone.
Larry, I mean, you're providing and selling solutions to to transit systems. When you pitch them, how much ROI do you have to prove?
Well, it depends. If it's a commercial entity where it's, you know, the money is by shareholders, you know, they're always looking for return on investment. When it's a public entity like a Metro Transit Agency, I think there's less of a justification, because what you're trying to provide is the service and also public safety and security. And so that's a requirement. I mean, that's a mandate in most cases. And so, and the government right now, through Homeland Security and the American Reinvestment Recovery Act, is funneling money into critical infrastructure security initiatives. Because, you know, the impact of one of these acts, if the homeland is hit again, or if the homeland is hit, I mean, we're talking about terrorism, which the whole concept is to terrorize the people in the city and the country. Because in America, we kind of feel that we're not vulnerable. We're insulated against the rest of the world because of the way we have oceans on either side. So I just think, you know, for the Metro Transit agencies, there's less of a need to provide that ROI. However, in the commercial entities, if you're talking about airlines or Greyhound or commercial bus companies, they're always going to do an ROI. And there is one. It's a way of how you can reduce cost on the investments, and through things like training and staffing. And there is a real ROI model that's possible to be done.
Good point. Let's talk about video surveillance a little bit here. We have a few questions on video surveillance. One of the topics that we did present on, of course, during the program was the value of video surveillance. Doug spoke about how the London Underground attacks really proved the value of cameras. Larry, you presented a case study that, in part of which, you know, detailed the video surveillance out there in Irvine, and we all clearly very, you know, advocated the use of video surveillance and other security technologies. One of the questions that came up was how long do you keep that video? And we had answered one of the questions in a little bit of Q&A that we had on the webinar about, you know, does video surveillance create liability? We said, no, it doesn't create liability. You know, keeping that video doesn't give you liability. So someone wanted to ask, well, you know, how long should you keep the video? They noted that in their city that the transit can only maintain those recordings for 72 hours before the images have to be overwritten or deleted. So is 72 hours enough in terms of saving video surveillance? Doug, how long did you guys keep video surveillance?
If it was a criminal case or some act of that we thought was terrorism, you could keep it. But normally we kept it for 30 days.
Okay, 30 days.
And you had 30 days, and you would reuse the tape again. But, I mean, if it was something that you was looking at, you put it in a property held room, it would become evidence.
Okay.
So you go up and take it off the train immediately or the bus immediately, and you put a property held number on it, and it's held.
Okay.
It become evidentiary at that point.
And I guess they're thinking about just the general video. So 30 days for general video that's not, you know, associated with an incident. Obviously, that goes into the evidence stores. Larry, what are you seeing? Is it 30 days that you're seeing common, or is it shorter?
I think it's 30 days too, and it's just because you can buy storage, and it's getting cheaper and cheaper. And just I look at other transportation segments where they have a requirement, and usually it's around 30 days.
Okay, 30 days. So yeah, I think that's a good tip for our listeners is you need to keep it for 30 days. I imagine they're probably fighting some sort of privacy and issue in that city that the public is not fully comfortable with video surveillance, and it may be more of a public relations campaign that needs to happen there to let the public understand the value of video surveillance on their transit system. Let's jump to a couple other sort of tech questions, if you will. We actually had, Larry, we had two that come in that I'll throw to you. They're actually about, you discussed the Irvine station. And they asked, were there any locations that couldn't be reached or hard to reach with traditional IP twisted pair cabling? And just for background for some of our non-techie listeners, Just the general trend in video surveillance has been to move to putting cameras over IP networks, these are Ethernet networks like your computer works on, rather than the old model of coaxial cable. It's just a technology change. So what were you facing, and how did you get around that?
Well, wireless is always an option, especially when the cost of construction or trenching is cost prohibitive. So you can always mount video cameras, and they go over a wireless IP network, or you can use fiber. So, but again, fiber, it can be expensive, and it could be some construction cost. There could be construction cost. Analysis has to be, is it cost prohibitive to run the wiring? Then in that case, you would use wireless. That's the best way to do it.
Okay.
The other issue with the Cat5 cable, which we talked about in Irvine, was that there is a length limitation for Cat5 of 330 feet, in which case we used fiber instead of using Cat5 wiring.
Okay. So you got a couple options there. Fiber if you want to go some long distances, wireless if you can't. Or can't afford to, or simply physically can't get that fiber out there on those long distance.
Correct.
Distances.
Okay. Correct.
Another question that came in on that, maybe you can discuss. They were asking about access control points in the building and whether that was tied into the video surveillance, and did video surveillance tie into the emergency phones? What was going on?
That was to me.
There's these
Code Blue emergency phones, which there were 16 of them in the parking garage. And what that is if you're if there's an incident, and it could be many things. It could be your car broke down. It could be someone suspicious in the parking garage. It could be someone following. If you go to the Code Blue phone, you pick it up. Remember we had security guards actually monitoring the cameras, but you had 40 cameras, so they're not watching all the cameras at all times. However, once you picked up that phone, the camera zoomed in on you and you became the prime focus for the security guard to see as you picked up the phone and began to talk to him about whatever it is you were communicating about. I think the other thing is about integrating access with video. I mean, that's really kind of a training issue. And also it's a learning issue, because if you have the same environment for your video and access, it's kind of like in the old days in computers, before we had Windows, you had to close applications before you could go into other applications. If you have one environment that you're comfortable with and you can work in, that's where there's a less training issue when you have both your access and video integrated.
Okay. Doug, one of the final questions we have here was regarding the sweeps. I think folks are very interested. You presented about how you instituted random sweeps of stations. And someone wanted to know, did you use metal detectors during those sweeps? And I think they meant, were you using the metal detectors on passengers to do any searches like that? Or what was the deal?
We went on with the wands that we had as we walked down. We scanned, didn't actually have the passengers stand up, but we scanned the bags with the wands. We had the bomb explosive dogs, plus we have drug dogs when we got on. And we took the mirrors and went all up over the top of the system while it was parked out. And we did the parking lots. We talked to the passengers as we walked through, and we told them this was a security sweep. We went in, and on our metro system, the operators are actually encased in a little room, so we went in and talked to the operator to make sure everything was all right. Did he see anything on the system, on the tracks that was and we needed to check out? And we was really on and off the train in probably 2.5 minutes.
Okay.
And it was gone. It went along, but once we finished, we went out in the parking lot. We looked. All the cars in the parking lot were swept with the mirrors.
Doug, how many officers? Go ahead.
Okay. It was a critique, but when you say how many officers, usually we'd have like a couple squads that was working. Like I told you, the officers didn't even know when the sweeps was going to happen. The commander would call them, say, meet me at a location, and at that point they'll tell them where they're going. And they would go in a caravan all officers will go together, and they pull in with the lights and block off the stations, shut it down for that time, and they go down in the stations, and they would take over and do their sweep.
Okay.
And it's very smooth and controlling. We first did it, the press wanted to know what was going on, but the press loved it. They were trying to find out when we were going to do it.
That's a great point. Well, that about wraps up our Q&A for today. Of course, this was the Q&A for our webinar on February 25th, 2010, Securing Public Transportation Systems. It featured Doug DeLever, former chief of police for Maryland's Transit Administration, Fred Jant, editor of Mass Transit Magazine, and also presenters from our sponsors, ADT Security Services and Hirsch Electronics. And, of course, we had on for this Q&A, we also had on Larry from ADT. So, gentlemen, thank you all for coming on for our Q&A, we hope our listeners have learned a little bit about transit security and some tips that they can take back to their own programs.